Firstly, I just want to acknowledge that amid the sadness, the grief, the loss, the bewilderment that is here in your community, what I have to say is very small biggies. I just want to put that out there. I hear your pain, and yes, my prayers are with you all as a community, and particularly those who are very close to all of this stuff. So I was asked today to say something or other about how I live out my faith in a secular job. It's very interesting, because times in my life I would have seen it as a secular job, and times when, like now, I don't even have that word secular in my vocabulary. So yeah, let me take you on a little bit of a journey. I always have trouble explaining what we do because it is so vast in some ways, but let's give it a crack. All right, here we go. This is the fundamental premise. The planet is hurting, so are the people. It's time for us to reconnect with both. And I guess for me, that's where this reading is so important. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength. For me, that's where my environmentalism comes from. It's a very deep consciousness of the role of God the Creator, putting this world together, and my responsibility towards the planet and the helping of the planet, and the sadness I feel about what happened at the last minute at COP26 and Australia's part in that whole business, taking Santos along to be in the Australian Pavilion and all that. But don't let me get started on it. The reconnecting with people is an interesting one as well, because I've spent a lot of my working life vacillating between working with wood and working with people. So let's have a bit of a look at this. First up, I've got a cup of soup. Now, people who know me know this is an oxymoron, right? I can't say a quick word about trees and wood, but I'm going to try really, really hard, okay? Trees and wood, something I'm very passionate about, and I always have been, but it's sort of found itself in expressions in different ways. I wanted to say a little bit about the role of trees in the creation story. If we go way back, a very long way back, hundreds of millions of years ago, the earth was covered in coniferous forests, in gymnosperms, the very ancient orders of plants, those with the naked seeds. So if you think about your pines and conifers and all that sort of stuff, they dominated the planet. Over time, a very long time, and they were there before there were any animals, birds, insects, fish, before there were any flowering plants. They were there for so long. They took the world's, they created our atmosphere. They took the oxygen level from 0.16% to 16%. So it's that role that trees have in converting carbon dioxide into oxygen. And so what they did is they took the atmospheric oxygen level up to a point that other life could be sustained. Pretty amazing. Now those forests, which once dominated the planet, now over a long period of time, buried in the ground, are where the fossil fuels come from. All of that trapped carbon that's in there is all from those forests. That's what ended up with it. The coal, the oil, the gas, it's all part of that process that's occurred there. And sadly, that's also, it's our learning to exploit that resource of solar energy trapped with the carbon in the ground as an energy source. That's what's got us to where we are now. Very interesting. So trees have this important part to play from way back. So when you think about the creation of the earth, trees are a part, incredible part of that creation story that has enabled life on this planet as we know it. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? We have some, what we see in rainforests, what we see in some of the ancient trees around us, and I'm not talking about the flowering trees, because they came along later. It wasn't until the end of the Cretaceous period that flowering plants and things emerged. But it's really interesting because those trees all testament to us about the longevity, the amazing way that they have survived for so long. Anyway, let's just move on from there. I've got to throw this in because this is so important. Carbon sequestration, the way that trees work is just amazing. So those leaves up there in the trees, they are drawing carbon dioxide out of the air. We've got water coming up out of the roots. We've got water being drawn from the air. And through the process of photosynthesis, we've got oxygen being given off as a byproduct of those sugars and starches. So this is all carbon chemistry. They're being pumped back down through the tree, and the tree is being built. So if you have a piece of wood, a little bit of she oak there, I see, 50% of that wood is, by weight, is carbon. So we need lots more carbon sequestered around us in buildings, houses, I mean, like we used to do. Now we've got high carbon, high energy, so high carbon things like steel, aluminium, glass, concrete is a terrible one, all those things. So we've kind of got, we used to live in wooden houses, but we've kind of gone off into a different direction. So we've got all this carbon that's locked up. Now, the way this whole thing works is remarkable. So if we want to do something about global warming, we actually have to make sure that we get trees back in to help to decarbonise the atmosphere. Very long-term process. Part of the reason we're here now is because we've removed so many trees, and as well as doing all the other stuff. So it's very interesting when you kind of put this in its context. I have wrote this in because this is an important part of the whole environmental message. We need more trees. But trees give us a whole lot more. As long as humanity's been around, trees have been a source of food and shelter. The role of providing oxygen for the forests is really important, pulling the carbon dioxide out of the air. The trouble is, as a result of the Industrial Revolution, which is only really 250 years old, what we've done is we've learned to tap into that resource of energy in the ground, and we've stuck it all in the air, so we put all this carbon in faster than the existing trees can pull it out. Wood is recyclable and reusable. It's a low-energy, renewable material, and I guess I see wood as being a gift from the trees. So for me, part of my whole expression of faith is about this real acknowledgement of wood as a significant part of the world that God has created. Trees have been a really important part of the way that creation has unfolded. It's just amazing what's happening. Anyway, let me move on from there. So for me, there's been this, my life has not been linear, sort of gone all over the place. A bit of a meandering journey. I have to throw this up here. I started working with people, I started as a youth worker. There's a couple of dubious characters here that you might know. Gavin Kempen and Michael Prince. And a few others in there. This is 1976. I did this thing for the Christian Volunteer Service, which is a good thing, man. And Michael was the coordinator of this. And for me, that was just fantastic. That's part of my formation as a person, was being part of this thing. I was working at the time with Team Crusaders. What a terrible name. Later, smartly changed the name to Fusion. And so I worked with them for a number of years. And that was, I went to Sydney in 77, and it was part of my kind of formation as a person, learning to live out my faith as a youth worker. We got burnt out. I went down to Augusta to stay for a year, stayed there for much of the next 20. I sort of went back off into woodworking, but then I ended up with all sorts of different youth working roles. And then along the way, because I had this sort of wood people thing, and I'd done a lot of work in labour market programs of long-term unemployed men and kids and so on, when the Gallup government stopped
logging in old growth forests, as they promised, after 10 years of heated debate about forest logging, I was asked to help look after the workers who were going to lose their jobs. What an amazing role that was. Started out as a 3-month contract for 3 days a week, and it went on for 7 years. Because when they made the decision, they didn't have a profile of the industry. They didn't know how many people were going to be affected. And 40, so I thought it was just a management Pemberton thing, but 40% of all the redundancies were in what they call the northern region, Perth, Metro and Peel. So it was very interesting. And so my youth working skills and stuff were very useful in there, but my knowledge of timber and how all that worked was very useful. So when I had to stand up in front of 200 very angry men in a sawmill and tell them, I'm here from the government, and this is what we're going to do for you, it was all deaf ears and anger. So I had to kind of navigate that stuff. Unfortunately, I've been prepared for these things in other bits of my life. What I learned very quickly, and I was able to help establish the way we worked, one of the things I made sure we went into people's homes, we sat with the person's spouse as well. Most of the time it was a she, and they were always ready to listen, as he's too caught up in his anger. And so we had this whole thing of working with the couple, because they were both affected by it. Yeah, it was a really amazing role, and it was fantastic leadership in many ways, the way the whole thing was managed. Though when we'd had a change in Premier, that got messed up, because Carpenter really couldn't care less about people and everything else at the time. So it was very interesting to kind of go through that stuff. I ended up in this sort of travelling journey of little contracts with the Department of Training. I ended up acting in the role of heading up the School of Wood and Drawing Art, which was in its death throes. But hanging around sawmills and hanging around the School of Wood fired up my love of teaching, but also my sawdust in my veins was activated. So I ended up going back on the tools. But along through this journey, I worked in an Indigenous community in Arnhem Land for a couple of years as a community development worker. I've done all sorts of crazy stuff, been in and out of having cabinet-making businesses. So, it's been a bit of a funny journey in many ways. I don't fit any boxes. So working with wood is one of those things that I come back to. Now, my father's a joiner. The last thing I wanted as a teenager was to be like him. So I had to define myself against him to work out who I was. So, no, I wasn't going to go into the trade. I went and became a youth worker instead. Actually, I had a very short stint at UWA doing science. And I was looking up at the ceiling in Winthrop Hall after about 6 months, and I did nothing, and I got up and walked out and never went back. And I think that, for me, that was the smartest thing I could ever have done. It was fantastic, but at the time my parents were traumatised because I was the first one in the family ever to get to university, and I just walked away. However, it's all part of the story. So here I am, I'm sort of back on the tools again, running these, working all this stuff, and then I was approached by an alternative learning program for those kids that don't fit within the school system. So you do some woodwork, you want to come and do some stuff with the kids? And I thought, okay. So we'd push the desks aside and bring in the benches and things, and these kids would make furniture, and they were never allowed into the manual arts in school because of behavioural stuff. They're always in a dong in the far corner of the school property, out of sight, out of mind. And so that sort of stuff just sort of started to get me back into this thing. And meanwhile, we had the waste management authorities sort of worried about the amount of organic waste going into the waste stream. So much of it is wood. You see that when you look at verge cleanups. It's abominable, isn't it? How much furniture and stuff is just dumped out there on the verge. Well, that's all going into landfill. So the big problem, because wood going into landfill in an anaerobic environment generates a lot of methane, which is a lot worse than carbon dioxide in the whole equation. So they're saying, right, how can we do this? And somebody knew about me and said, well, Greg could come in and teach people how to recycle that wood. So I did. I went on for a few years. I just sort of set up these workshops and people would come along, and it's amazing how many kitchen spatulas you can make out of a wooden barbecue trolley. But it's all part of this sort of journey when I'm exploring how to kind of do this stuff. And what happened with my poor woodworking business, I ended up doing so much of the other stuff that I didn't have time to deal with my customers anymore. And at some point I had to take a crack of an idea, and this is where the idea evolved. So in 2009, when I was running this cabinet making joinery business, and I was doing this mobile workshop, so I'd hire somebody like Earthwise and run back-to-back workshops for a week, and people would come in and do all this sort of crazy stuff. And then I made things worse by going overseas through this. I went and looking at woodworking projects with disadvantaged youth in Washington, D.C. So I was there with my wife for a holiday, and she's getting dragged around from one project to another. And then in 2011, when we went to the UK on another holiday, I went and looked at 9 different community wood recycling projects. So this was pushing all the buttons for me, because I've got people coming in that's all about recycling wood, because in Europe it costs money to dump wood. So all the stuff that's got paint or poisons goes in barges into Germany, and they put it through their biomass power stations where the scrubbers could pull the nasty chemicals out. They generate energy from it. But in the UK, couldn't do that. And so wood has to, they've got to find a way to recycle it. Someone is generating lots of wood, then these community wood recycling projects would come along and they would be paid to take the wood away. And then have people out of prison, people with disabilities, refugees, all getting employment to be able to work with this stuff. So when you get a pair of little gates off an old lock, this, you know, 200-year-old oak and this sort of stuff, there's a lot of wood in that. There was at the time £200 in money worth of steel in all the fixings and hinges and everything else. So all the nails being pulled out, all being saved, and they're generating money. It's like, it's just awesome. I just wanted to do that when I came home. Of course, when you've got no capital and no infrastructure, you've got to start from somewhere. 2013, I went to the US to learn green woodworking skills. This time I didn't take Rosemary and make her endure. By the way, she apologises for not being here today. We had a 21st birthday last night at our house. She's our oldest granddaughter, which makes me feel really old. And there were still bodies everywhere this morning. So I tiptoed out of the house. Well, I said, just stay, sort it out. So I'm still doing all this stuff, juggling, trying to do some custom work, but doing more and more of these crazy workshops and silly stuff with people, with wood. It's working with people, but wood was just the medium that we were using, and there's that strong environmental message going through all the way. And then somebody gave me the opportunity to utilise some unused warehouse space. This is the game changer, because then you could actually have tools hanging on the wall instead of pulling them out of boxes that were in a trailer, and you could have regular people come through. And that's what got us into the whole area of private tuition. So out of this, the Heritage Woodcraft Centre was born. So this sort of scramble of stuff, people, wood, and the desire to want to work with and help people and treat people well who are not normally treated well. But all, this is the real key to it. There's this fundamental need to be creative. People are inherently creative. It's right at the very core of our nature, and you see it in kids before we squeeze it out of them. They want to be creative. In the modern world, we can kind of lose touch easily with that desire to be creative. That creativity can be expressed in music and all sorts of different ways. And the resurgence of interest in traditional crafts reflects that desire to be creative, but also the social engagement. Wasn't it interesting to see what happened in the COVID time? You could not buy cooking ingredients to save your life. There were the crocheting, you name it, even macrame's made a comeback. Can you imagine that? So it's this need to be creative, to stay sane. Not such a big problem for us here in Fortress WA, but for in other parts of Australia and other parts of the world where people are locked down for long periods, going stir crazy, that going back to handcrafts, doing all that stuff online, I loved all the choir things going on. These are how they did the technology and have all these people all over the world playing music and singing together. Like, it was just so creative. It was lovely. So there's that desire to be together, express things creatively. There's so many benefits from using our hands. Hand tool woodworking, which is what I'm on about, is a very sensual experience. Because when you're working with the wood, you can feel it, you can hear it, you can see it, and often you can smell it. If there's no machine to take all that away, then you get really close to it. There's this really strong connection between our hands and our brain. And that's something that's so important in child development. It's also, we do a lot of work with people with acquired brain injuries, especially for motor vehicle trauma. So when you're trying to get utilising brain plasticity to get the connections happening so that somebody working with their hands is helping to reconnect their body with their brain and get parts of the brain working again. It's just so powerful. Body awareness. You know, you get some of these kids whose totally their brains are disconnected from their bodies. They've got no idea where they are. But as they learn to use something like a handsaw, and they get to feel there's the macro and the micro muscle movements going on. And it's so good for body awareness, the hand-to-eye coordination, spatial relations, you know. And then there's a sense of empowerment that comes when you've made something and you're really pleased with it, you know. It's also, of course, a low-carbon activity because wood is a beautiful low-carbon thing, and without needing electricity for power tools and machines and things, it just means that that energy is coming from your body. Fantastic. It's also environmentally sustainable doing this stuff by hand, which people for millennia before us kind of knew. So there's this kind of magic of making that we love to share with people. It's about building self-confidence and that sense of empowerment that people get from doing it. It also builds community. Gets connections with people, because when people are creative together, they tend to open up and talk. And that's one of the principles behind the origins of the men's shed movement. It's about, as a key part of Australia's mental health strategy for men, is getting people, not, because blokes don't necessarily talk well face to face, but they'll talk shoulder to shoulder. So when you're working on something side by side together, or across the bench from each other, then that's a very powerful way of getting people to connect who might not normally connect. It also builds a respect for trees and for timber, because as you get to understand the material more, people often want to know where it came from. And so there's that. That's what I love about the green woodworking. That's the pre-industrial stuff, where you start with a chunk of tree, you split it open and you make things out of it while it's still green and soft, which is a tradition that goes back for millennia. Builds resilience. Oh, crap, I've just messed that up. That's not the end of the world. There's problem solving we can do. There's all of those things that can happen when maybe we have to start again, but it's not such a big deal because I've already figured out how to do that part of it. Courage is thinking and action regarding sustainable living. Hey, I don't have to throw out that old chest of drawers. I can actually take the wood out of it and make it into something else. And so that's kind of part of the magic of what's going on with this. So this is a thing that started when we got some space. I used to say, I. Now I say, because I'm not in this alone. I'm very privileged to have this guy up the end here, Tyson Mink, working with me. He's a gem, you know. I'm so honoured and privileged to have him working with me. I just wish I could have him more. So the therapeutic woodworking has sort of evolved out of this stuff. The people with acquired brain injuries, people with all sorts of, like from PTSD to mental health stuff. We've got kids with autism and hyperactivity. Got all sorts of people coming in who don't necessarily fit out there in the community well. And when they come to us, they find a place. They're also learning and gaining lots of skills and lots of sort of good stuff about themselves when they don't necessarily fit the norm. So the therapeutic woodworking has grown, especially through the COVID stuff. So when COVID came along, when we got first that bigger lockdown, what we had here in Perth, we lost all of our work, because all of our work involved face-to-face. So that sort of took us off down this other rabbit hole, because Tyson was able to get some work with the boatyard. I was glad he didn't stay there. He was able to sort of get him back out of there eventually. But all I could do was to get some funds to stay afloat was to start selling the tools off the wall. So I set up an online shop. And then kind of went from there, was selling wood, became agents for some other imported tools, all that sort of gear. So we had that going on. We lost all of this stuff. So I just set up a YouTube channel, doing things there, just sort of keeping things alive, waiting to see where are we going to go now. But when you couldn't work with groups, so all the workshops and things we used to do all disappeared, but we could start to do one-on-one. So the therapeutic woodworking, which is sometimes one-on-one plus a carer who might have brought the person with them, then that filled up our week. So the demand for it was great. So it sort of changed the direction of the business, but into a very lovely way, really. So this is what's kind of in this evolution of this thing, of where we're sort of going to, is what we've done is we've created a safe space. So I've got people who, it's how we do it as well. This little guy here is autistic. He also has all sorts of other developmental issues as well. And he, this day, is having a panic attack. Now, for a while, I've been taking my granddaughter's dog on Tuesday mornings to work, because he's magic for these kids. And in this case, like, sometimes he's just horribly hyperactive, this dog, and he's a real pain. But he pulls out the magic like this. So this little guy's sitting there having a panic attack just with his hand on the dog, just doing this. And then later on, he stands up and he comes back to the bench and he says, "I'm back," and he starts doing his thing. And then it came around and hit him again. So he goes back to the dog, who's not always sitting around, but the dog seemed to know he needed him. It's just, we've often seen that in dogs, haven't we? But so I'll see where the dog here is gold, even if he is a pain in the bum sometimes. When these kids walk in, he's so excited, he runs round and around, barking, chasing his own tail. It's just infuriating, and all I can do is step in front of him so he crashes into my leg. And then he'll sort of stay there for a bit and then he'll start doing it again. But he's gold. So there's two of these kids. The mother loves bringing them there, loves me having Simba there, because it's a place where he can have his panic attacks. Some days he just screams and shouts, and other days it's pretty good. You don't know what you're going to get. The mother knows that these kids are accepted, whatever space they're in. There are times when I will, have to draw the line in the sand. You will not threaten your mother with that chisel. All that sort of stuff. And that, so it's not just to kind of let things go. Also, times when I've actually physically removed him from the workshop, said, "You're not welcome in here if you're going to, threaten people. So do come back in if you want to be different." So, but we've got all this amazing stuff. I have to share this with you. We have a growing number of really interesting people who are coming in and wanting to find a safe space. So I had one start up recently. She's autistic, she's 55. She's struggled in workplaces, because the autism wasn't actually diagnosed until relatively recently. That was sort of gave a descriptor of what was really going on for her. And I got this email from her. She'd been, there, I think, four times. And she said, I'm really enjoying my woodworking, and on a broader note, your parts of Marcus and John's company. I feel accepted just as I am. This makes me teary with both joy and a bit sad, but I've had to feel so different and out of place in other places, like more than a few workplaces in the past. But now I feel I can move on from this sadness as I've done before, rather than sink into greater depression and sadness. No idea what comes next, but I'm feeling stronger lately. I'm gaining renewed confidence in my interpersonal skills and a willingness to connect that I have not been prepared to do the last few years until I sought out the joy of water and my current art therapy. Thank you so much. I am enjoying my journey. That's pretty amazing. Tyson and I, at the time when that email came in, we were actually having a chat about this issue with lots of people, some of our clients and some others wanting to hang around, not in their normal sessions. And this one came in, and it was a very teary moment for both of us because it was so real. We have other people who just want to be there. So that raised a whole lot of problems for us. Is how do we manage these people who want to be there? We're not really a drop-in centre. People are usually funded under the NDIS or out of their own pocket or through the Insurance Commission, WA, or wherever they are, whatever sort of system, family trust funds, you name it. That's how they're funded to come in. But we've got this people desiring to be there because it's a safe space where they feel accepted, where they are building community with others, which they wouldn't normally have. And so that's a growing challenge, this whole thing about a safe space. Got another person who has PTSD, and she actually lives in an abusive relationship. Her husband, and he does FIFO. When he's out, she wants to be at our workshop as much as possible. She's happy to do anything, vacuum, make tea, you know. She spends hours cleaning up old tools and all sorts of things, but she just wants to be in the space. And I was really busy one day, and I didn't have time to take the stuff down to the post office to send out our orders, because we send tools and wood to people all over Australia now. And so I gave her my car, and I gave her the details on lots of parcels, and I asked if she'd go there. And she came back, she was just in tears. She said, thank you so much for your interest in me. But you know, she said, you don't realise how big that is for me, that you trusted me with your car and stuff to go and do that job. It was just lovely. So it's kind of interesting territory, this stuff. All right. So there's another bit of what we do. That's about this reclaiming traditional skills. Lots of people have lost the ability to fix things, to make things, because people are not taught how to do that. It's not a part of what we do. We just go to IKEA and buy another one. Stick the other one out on the verge. So basic traditional skills are being lost and often not being passed on to our kids. So there's sort of this multi-generational loss of skills. And of course, timber can be recycled almost indefinitely. And so when you've got the traditional skills and the knowledge and the commitment to recycling and everything else, it helps to reduce waste. But also the thing about these sort of tools is that, and Tyson and I are always going on about the old tools that we love. We don't find much plastic in our workshop. Lots of the saws links could be used over 100 years old. And they all have a story. But all these tools reflect our changing social history. So you think about the Industrial Revolution, and then what we saw in particular in the 19th century was this incredible explosion of technological developments. So the US Patent Office, which started in 1830, ended up with all of these things, people putting patents in left, right and centre for new ideas to develop this tool further or whatever. And they all tell a story. And I've got a saw on the wall, which instead of having a wooden handle, it has the very first of the plastic handles, plastic type. Kodak Eastman were the ones playing with plastics. They were trying to develop a flexible film. And so they that was going to be more longer lasting than the old stuff they were using. And so they cooked up this material. This is before Bakelite, and they called it Tentonite. And the big American saw company, Distin, got the patent to be able to use that. They called it Distinite. So we had the first plastic hand saw. This is about 1930. But the market didn't like it. So the market wasn't ready. But it's part of that evolution of materials and things.
And then they kind of emerged again in the 70s, and off we went. So this is all part of what we do. It's helping people understand changes in history and changes in our world and make sense of it all and the beautiful, consistent stuff going through it. But the scope of our activities is evolving. I used to do lots of school incursions. It's hard work, isn't it? Lugging gear into a primary school somewhere, do your thing, lug it out again. We've actually stopped doing that post-COVID, so draw a line under it. So after doing it for about 12 years, it's a bit sad to let it go. There's another part of me that felt a great sense of relief. I haven't got time for that anymore. We've got all this private tuition to do. We used to do a lot of stuff in festivals. So we have a tent and we have hundreds of kids coming through and making stuff. There'd be 32 hammers banging away and there's saws going and all sorts of stuff. And I used to have people walk into the tent and they'd start to tear up and they'd say, "This reminds me of my granddad's workshop." You know, and so we'd have a chat and we'd talk about how they had to straighten the nails or that in the Depression because, you know, if you couldn't get nails and couldn't afford to buy a new one, so their job as a kid was to straighten all the nails. And, you know, the colour of their stuff comes out of people. It just triggers this. But there's less of that. COVID sort of killed that for now. The public workshops, well, that's still out there. We still do some of those where people from the public can come and sign up for things. The private workshops, that's sort of shifting a bit, sort of going off into libraries and community centres and working with bunches of homeschool kids and so on, because there isn't room in our workshop to do all these group stuff. Heritage demonstrations and interactive displays. This is a lot of fun, but this is a growing area. People are interested in the past. So Tyson and I will be dressed for the part and we'll be demonstrating. And of course, because we like people, we're always doing the interactive thing. And people get to have a go on a cross-cut saw and do all that sort of stuff. It's about connecting them with the history. So we're always talking history. You'd be pleased to know that, Claire. The online shops is growing, private tuition, we still have people come in who just want to learn skills. But the dominant thing we're doing is this therapeutic woodworking. And now we've got this problem with this growing group of people who want to come in and volunteer and be there. So it's a sort of flexible thing. So when I ring up the health department and say, "Look, I need some clarification about the people needing to be vaccinated. Because we have people with disabilities, people who are without disabilities, sometimes concurrently in the same space, do we need to make sure that everybody is vaccinated? All the staff and all the volunteers and top that group." And I say, "What do you think?" Right. Well, we don't fit. It's like with the last round of stuff of the state government, you know, the last of the lockdown. Yeah, mainly small businesses lost trade in that time. They now and it's a little bunch of ISO codes. Well, we don't fit. Because we do this, that, so it's kind of really interesting. What we do doesn't fit anything. It's just this weird expression. For me,
this is an expression of, "So the love you want your God with all your heart, soul, mind and strength." That's where the environmental commitment comes from. And we need to communicate with people the importance of the planet and the importance of the fact that we are so small. And our activity on this planet is a tiny blip in the length of history. Love your neighbour as yourself is the other thing. That's all this crazy stuff we do with people. Where we accept everybody that comes in. We like to help people to find the potential, to develop their skill, to find who they are, to connect with one another, and to connect with us. And that's the key. It's about us. It's about the way that we connect with the people who come in. Tyson and I come from different backgrounds. We have a whole lot of different skills and things, but we share a whole lot of stuff. One of those is that we're both gentle. He's quieter than me. But we're both pretty quiet, gentle people, and we like to create a space that is that people can feel safe, where people want to be there. And so it wouldn't work if it wasn't for the fact that we were the people that were kind of doing this engagement with others. So I want to acknowledge before this community, this lovely gentleman over here, he has been a key part of this part of the evolution of how I express my faith on a daily basis, not in a secular way, but in some sort of weird integrated way. And so anyway, how do you describe us? I don't know. We're kind of trying to make a difference to the world, one piece of wood at a time. You might like to have any questions. Anyone here? I've rant and rave for a while. Is there anything we must see one another? Yeah.
Great. I'm not sure if you're aware of it. A friend of mine said bees. People that have hives can't get beehive made now. They're just not available. So it might be an in for it.
I actually looked at that a while ago.
Yeah.
The problem is, I don't do custom work anymore. I'm too busy.
Yeah, okay.
Cool. So that's, if you could find a way to have people who, you know, who put their training to be able to do that stuff and love doing it and make it available to the industry, that would be really great, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, that requires capital and time.
Yeah, okay.
And
just, that are missing. Just,
but yeah, you're right. There are lots of things that are missing. Beehives is one of those. At the moment, you can't find a trade to save yourself. We've got huge inflation, the spinal, lots of things at the moment, and the rest.